Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 94, section 4, which is old single column, page 1031. All right. So, recall that we've had this, you know, quite complicated process, sequence that the Indian subcontinent has been going through, you know, related to the Melchizedek missionaries, you know, coming into that area. You know, it started with what it finally settled into Vedism. You know, there was a lot of complicated precursor context to what was going on there in India. You most immediately had the, you know, that final Andite invasion, the so-called Aryan invasion, an initial complexity of evolutionary religious concepts that the Melchizedek missionaries were stepping into, and then all of the back and forth with the Brahmin priesthood that finally solidified into Vedism, and then that morphed into kind of a curious transition stage of Brahmanism, which in the midst of them losing any definitive personal God concept, nonetheless, they, as we saw in section 3, they came up with a number of the basic kind of essences of some very transcendent philosophic recognitions, things that you don't even begin to fully appreciate how they were approaching something real until you get the fifth epical revelation all these years later. And as we mentioned, even with the fifth epical revelation, to fully appreciate how they were approaching some genuine elements of reality and deity, you need to kind of take off from the immediacy of the Urantia book, follow their clues, their suggestions, and unpack things more deeply than they were allowed to reveal directly. On the one hand, it had some unfortunate degradations, I guess you might say, of quality, but then on the other hand, it had these little elements of faint flickers of transcendent recognition, spattered around in the midst of a lot of confusion and ignorance, which as time went on. More and more of of southern India, more and more of the Deccan, and the very primitive ideas began to bleed in and complicate things. And so, so all of that said and done, they want to give you this final little summation of what came out the other side of all that complexity forward to the present time as what is called Hinduism. You know, so from Vedism through Brahmanism, sort of directly into Hinduism. And I think everyone knows, and we've mentioned it several times. What was that? What was that? Yeah, we haven't gotten to that yet. That's coming next. They'll mention here at the beginning, you know, then subsequent things make Hinduism even more complicated, like Buddhism. You've got the, as I was about to say, we all know, and we've said a number of times that it's just an extremely complicated evolutionary religious phenomenon there in India. It's every time they come up with a new notion, it morphs into 15 flavors, and then each of those 15 flavors morphs into 20 different interpretations, and things that were defined get redefined, and there's a flavor of Hinduism basically for every person. It is just endlessly complicated, and you can't linearly follow what it is at all. It just ends up being a giant complexity that people sort of just get into one little nook or cranny of it and just play there. And, everyone else has their own sandbox that they play in. They're going to bring some of those elements out. I think that's all we need to say. Plenty said up front here. Let's get into it here.
Section 4, the Hindu religion. With the passing of the centuries in India, the populace returned in measure to the ancient rituals of the Vedas as they had been modified by the teachings of the Melchizedek missionaries and crystallized by the later Brahmin priesthood. This, the oldest and most cosmopolitan of the world's religions, has undergone further changes in response to Buddhism and Jainism, and to the later appearing influences of Mohammedanism and Christianity. But by the time the teachings of Jesus arrived, they had already become so occidentalized as to be a white man's religion, hence strange and foreign to the Hindu mind.
Okay. As we know, as you're saying there right up front, the things that the Brahmin priesthood set up back with Vedism definitely continued forward, and you can see there was some tendency to kind of fall back and engage that anew and rework it and process it, like we were saying. Upanishads, continue on ad nauseum, but you did have the reworked stuff from the Melchizedek missionaries in there. We all know you still had a definitive Brahmin priesthood, like they're saying there. They say it's the most cosmopolitan. Like I said, here it is right in the very first paragraph. It just continued to complexify. You get in the 6th century BC, you get Buddhism spawned, and that complexifies it. Also in the 6th century, you have Jainism with all of its additional complexities, and that gets fed into it. And then, way forward into the AD, 6th century AD, 6th century AD and forward, you have Mohammedanism, and Christianity as well. It's you know, not to mention eventually you have Sikhism, of course, coming into play there too, and in that area. So it's a very, very complex domain of evolutionary religious thoughts that have everything from an element that, like we were saying, from the Romantic philosophy that, you know, is quite transcendent, to something that is so incredibly primitive and just grotesque, you know, relative to genuine religion, you know, that it's hard to imagine how the two could be anywhere remotely connected to each other, you know, all under one name of Hinduism. Now, you know, here we have again that white man's religion concept, and you know, we'll bring that out some more. That you know, we all know from part four that you know, that's one of the kind of the unfortunate things that even though Jesus spent all that time with Canon and Gonad directly engaging people from India, by the time it came back, you know, to India as, you know, budding Christianity, you know, it wasn't anything really like what Jesus had engaged Gannad and Gonad with.
Chris?
Yep.
Aren't these gods in India, Indian gods, Hindu gods, same as Greek gods? That, you know, they changed
names. We'll get to that a little bit here. Let's just, remind me when we get to item number three to bring that out a little bit. Let's just start with the little preface in item number one there and then talk a little bit about that.
Hindu theology at present depicts four descending levels of deity and divinity. One, the Brahman, the absolute, the infinite one, the it is.
Okay, so notice in that little preface, four descending levels of deity and divinity. Okay, deity is not capitalized. Divinity is not capitalized. Okay, when all is said and done, I mean, you have something that is still so bottom-up colored, so lacking in a solid, objective, top-down recognition of literal deity, capital D deity. You don't want to capitalize those words. You know, it's basically just the extent to which it's appropriate to kind of use the words deity and divinity in the ghost cult framework. Right? Nothing, you know, really proper of recognition at all to it. But we're calling this the Hindu religion. You know, like we've said so many times, even though when you're dealing with evolutionary religion, no one's consciously, genuinely doing religion. Right? You know, no matter how much we call it that, it's not religion in fact. It's, you know, it's a conscious phenomenon, and it's only religion in truth. Because, I mean, it is all caught up in material, temporal issues. You know, it's not something that is bound back to eternity, the RE in religion. You know, so it's you know, it's only appropriate to call this, you know, or any other thing that we call religion, Christianity or whatever, it's only appropriate to call that religion the degree to which kind of unconsciously the reason the person is coming up with these schemes about matter and, you know, and temporal issues is because he has a subtle, superconscious motivation, in that direction. It's not because anyone has a very direct conscious predicate of eternity and spirit substance and, you know, such genuine religious issues, elements. Yep.
Did Jesus ever use the word religion?
Yeah, I mean, Jesus certainly talked about science, philosophy, and religion. Yeah, I mean, you know, you don't remember that stuff, of course, from the New Testament because, you know, you know, the apostles couldn't understand that sort of stuff. But you know, when you read part four, you can see especially at times, you know, like, say, during Jesus' pre-public ministry around the Mediterranean, you know, he's engaging Greek philosophers and talking in, you know, great detail about, you know, a lot of things. You know, when he's dealing with the clamoring masses in Galilee that just want free food and free health care, okay, he's not going to get off in some complex discussion about, you know, the relationship of philosophy to science and religion or something.
It was all paper
and religion. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so, but anyways, you know, so just, you know, just notice that. I mean, you know, that's, you know, that's a precise thing. Notice when they don't capitalize deity. So they're reminding you it's kind of like saying capital D deity in quotes, you know, as it were, you know. It's very bottom up. Okay, then number one, so that basic fuzzed out starting concept of Brahmanism, the Brahman, you know, we all know that gets fed forward into Hinduism. And it takes on a number of different flavors. Like they're pointing out, you know, in some senses, it's a concept that's kind of sort of like what you might call the absolute. In other contexts, it's a concept that you might kind of sort of call the infinite one. Yeah, I mean, it's always appropriate to kind of think of it as a vague sort of starting point in contrast to the I am as the it is, right? Because it's definitely not personalized. You know, thinking of it as kind of the infinite one, where oneness is indivisibility. You know, especially when you're dealing with non-dualistic Hinduism, like we were talking about last time, where kind of when all is said and done, I mean, everything that appears to be separate individuality, you really conclude is really sort of just an illusion of the Brahman kind of pretending to have, been fragmented or individuated into something else, but really, when all is said and done, it all melts back in, or you could say it never really was separate in the first place. So it's all kind of just one indivisible infinite, you know, or one indivisible infinity. Okay? You know, definitely, you know, having that sort of indivisibility, that oneness, is in play in those sorts of ideas where there really isn't any separating a drop from the ocean, right? The ocean just, you know, is, and it covets all of its elements, right? Absolutely. So the Brahman concept gets used to a greater or lesser degree, depending on who's playing with it in Hinduism. You know, and if they do play with it to any significant amount, you know, it sort of is used in a way that manipulated to match the rest of their agenda and how they're constructing their whole theologic scheme. And so it's a very kind of, you know, formless concept, and that's very important. I mean, to start with that kind of you know, setting aside things like the absolute, the infinite one, the it is, start with just that vague concept of formlessness. I mean, that's a very key thing about the Brahman. Okay, and that comes into play in contrast to that formless in the next element here, in item number two.
Two, the Trimurti, the supreme trinity of Hinduism. In this association, Brahma, the first member, is conceived as being self-created out of the Brahman, infinity. Were it not for close identification with the pantheistic infinite one, Brahma could constitute the foundation for a concept of the universal father. Brahma is also identified with fate.
So, you know, just that last little element, you know, is that very, very ancient thing of fate, you know, so, you know, not surprisingly, that kind of gets morphed in and identified with one of these elements. Okay, but the first thing is, okay, what is this Trimurti thing? What's the deal with that word? Okay, it literally means three forms, in contrast to formless, the Brahman. Okay, and the idea is that, you know, in some sort of mystical way, that which is innately formless takes you know, a form. But, you know, when the Brahman is transcendent, it's like, well, is it really taking form, or is it just kind of pretending and fooling people, you know, that it's form? But nonetheless, that's the kind of the contrast they're playing with. It, you know, is trying to give the formless form in three different ways. A creator way, a destroyer way, and a preserver way. Yeah. And now the degree to which, you know, you have a preserver or a maintainer, kind of an upholder, you know, that you shouldn't be surprised if that ends up being the element that gets played with a lot. You know, it's like, oh, all the different possibilities within the wholeness of upholding. See, that's, you know, there's a, underneath the surface, you've got the, you know, a mother deity aspect there. But first off, you know, the first member of the Trimurti is Brahma. And so that's your creator element. You know, that's sort of the formless taking form as need be to create. Okay. And like they're saying, it's like, well, okay, that maybe that's, you know, especially since you, when you say self-created, oh, that sounds a bit like the first source and center. I mean, maybe we could work with that, move that to a more, you know, take it out of the ghost cult and human anthropomorphic notions and whatnot and evolve it into relationship with genuine reality. But the problem is, this is not taking form out of the I am concept. It's taking form out of the it is concept. Right? So it's like you're saying, that infinite one is a pantheistic infinite one. You know, like I said, I mean, it's, you know, it's so pantheistic that, and when all is said and done, you really say that there really isn't anything except just the formless. And all form is just kind of an illusion. Okay? And an impersonal, you know, formless and underlying illusions at that.
And that's what I say when I get on the scale.
It's an illusion. Yes. No, your form is not an illusion. But round is a shape. Yes.
That huge meal I had was very vivid.
Yes, the clever species of self-deception that we use with ourselves. Anyway, so, you know, that's what we're getting at. And like I said before, remember that, you know, in a little synopsis like this, if you're not familiar with Hinduism, in a little synopsis like this, So, oh, okay, that's a, so it's definitively Brahma's that. It's like, no, you know, go and look up one of these things, and it's like, wait a minute, it seems like there's 98 different ways of thinking about this. And it's just, it's endlessly complicated. Nothing is simple and definitive. You know, and to one sect, Brahma means one thing, to another sect, it means another thing, and it's just, you know, like I said, it's very ad hoc, you know, when all is said and done. Okay, what about the other two members?
The worship of the second and third members, Shiva and Vishnu.
You can say Shiva or Shiva.
Okay, Shiva and Vishnu arose in the first millennium after Christ. Shiva is Lord of life and death, God of fertility, and master of destruction. Vishnu is extremely popular due to the belief that he periodically incarnates in human form. In this way, Vishnu becomes real and living in the imaginations of the Indians. Shiva and Vishnu are each regarded by some as supreme over all.
Yeah, so let's start with the last thing. So, you know, so on the one hand, you could say first member, second member, third member, but, you know, that you don't get universal agreement on that. I mean, right, there, you know, there's kind of three big divisions, subdivisions of Hinduism, you know, in a certain sense. And even me saying that is controversial in the wholeness of Hinduism. But, you know, there's those that put Brahma first, there's those that put Shiva first, and there's those that put Vishnu first. And you go, well, that's just ridiculous. It's like, well, okay, think about it. You know, set aside how silly their thoughts and stuff might be on the surface. But remember, like we've talked about, I mean, it's not some sort of only way to think about reality to describe starting with what we call the first source and center, and then going to the second source and center, and then going to the third source and center, et cetera, unpacking the I am in that way. Because, you know, it isn't really a temporal sequence. They didn't really get unpacked in that sequence. That they're coexistential facts, right? You could also, you know, penetrate into the wholeness of that from the other side, from the other end, and start with what we call the third, and have that be first. Okay, you know, remember, you know, kind of in a very transcendent way, that difference of instead of starting with the first source and center side, instead of starting with this kind of what the budding father side of it is. If you start from the other side, you know, you're starting with basically the mother side of the picture. And notice again, just if you put them in that order, Brahma, Shiva, Vishnu, like I was saying, if, you know, once you've recognized the fullness of the nature of Mother Deity, which means kind of going beyond the immediacy of the revelation, unpacking some of their suggestions. But once you start to really kind of understand what Mother Deity is more, you know, when you, all you have to do is just bring up some little description of them starting to talk about Vishnu, and you go, there's kind of shades of, you know, the finite upholder there. You know, and having that concept, as they're pointing out, be a womb for birthing many incarnations, many avatars. You know, that, you know, you don't necessarily have Hindus interpreting things that way, okay, but see, you can kind of notice that there's a kind of maybe an unrecognized thread of truth in the midst of what they're talking about. Yeah, I mean, kind of more up front, I'll get you in a second, Amy, kind of more up front is, look, we're taking the form thing one more notch. So, you know, we start with formless, and we have a threefold kind of primary form expression, and then with Vishnu, he can take many, many avatar subforms. And one of the most popular amongst many is Krishna, of course. So you get all the way to this third level, if you will, of form specificity, but then some really focus on that and put Krishna at the top of everything. It's like, well, wait a minute, if Krishna's came from Vishnu, isn't Vishnu inherently above? It's like, it gets re-rationalized, and things that you are kind of inconvenient just kind of get shoved off to the side, and you just focus on what works in your scheme. And that's, like I said, it's kind of like trying to follow a given God notion in Sumerian or Babylonian. And each person that tells the myth uses the same names in a different way. This time, this one's the father and this one's the son. And the next time, it's the other way around. The one that was the son is now the father. These names just get reworked and stuff. So it's very complicated. Yeah, okay, Amy, you had something.
So I was just pursuing on this material. Mm-hmm. Because when I was in India, mm-hmm. I studied Hinduism, but I also studied Buddhism. And the Buddhism I studied was looked at Buddha as a Brahman or more of a Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So in that aspect. So I just kind of have this problem with dissecting. Or I'm kind of on that moral ground of having a little bit of trouble dissecting what is a deity, big D, little D, or a womb ma. I think it's important at the same time to try to understand the material. So any more suggestions
to
help with the dissection of the womb?
Yeah. See, kind of what we're, remember what the reason the revelators here in the fifth epoch of Revelation are going into all this is, what we're reading here isn't the main point of the fifth epoch of Revelation. It's saying, okay, you, if you're a Hindu, you think basically in this framework. Now, notice what elements of your framework we highlighted and what ones we sort of just let be. And now go to the other parts that are more directly trying to, present to you the real nature of deity, the real nature of personalized deity, God. Okay, and reflect on the difference between your attempts to try to figure out what this God inclination is within you, try to put words to it, objects to it. Compare what humans have come up with to what is the objective nature of things. And notice that we are, we as the revelators of the fifth epoch of Revelation are definitely asking you to make a very stark contrast factually, what you thought were facts, like Brahma, Shiva, Vishnu, okay? What you thought were facts, okay, those aren't actually facts. There isn't actually a God, right, that is Shiva or Vishnu or whatever, okay? But even though on the surface factually, you're nowhere near reality, if you can courageously reflect on how you've got little threads of truth woven through what you call facts. And even though those aren't facts, there's a thread of truth that does line up with an objective fact. And I've been trying to kind of point that out a little bit. The degree to which the Brahman concept kind of is like the absolute. Well, there really is the absolute, that facet of deity that's called the absolute. Okay, in terms of the reality perspective, you have the three absolutes: the unqualified absolute, the universal absolute, the deity absolute, and how those can be thought of together as the absolute. And so those real objective concepts, once you understand them in the fifth epoch of Revelation, you can go back and see, oh, I see there is a little shade of that that they played with the Brahman concept. You know, they didn't have it well focused and well separated from other things. You know, the other stuff kind of gets blurred in and confuses it. But you know, if you set all that aside, it's like, well, they kind of sort of had the beginnings of a recognition of that facet of deity that's called the absolute. Or maybe the facet of deity is called the supreme. You know, they were getting an, you know, remember when we were reading Brahmanic philosophy, we saw them mentioning the supreme. Sometimes they're not going way up. They're really kind of thinking as that which encompasses the totality of the finite. Not that's, you know, absolutely transcendent of the finite is the absolute. Right? And so they're kind of getting at the supreme. So they're trying to help us to find our on-ramps. Every one of us is coming from some evolutionary tradition, whether it's Hindu or Buddhist or Christian or whatever it is. And, you know, when all is said and done, they're going to want you to take a big eraser to what you think are the facts in that tradition. Okay, but they want you to recognize that they're not really taking you apart from where you are. In truth, you're going to still be where you were, even though factually it will be totally different. You won't be using, though, you know, you won't be talking about Osiris anymore or something. But there's a thread of truth that you have in your evolutionary context that you can hold on to firmly. And just follow it out of your evolutionary confusion, match it up with what's objectively real, and see how it isn't like it initially appeared, where they were asking you to lose everything that you hold dear. Really, you're going to hold on to what you really hold dear, the truth. You're going to let go of what isn't really fact. And if you're honest with yourself, you never were really holding on to that in the first place. You thought you were, but you weren't really. I mean, there's so many things that humans have believed for hundreds of years or even millennia that technically, you know, are invalid. But there's a thread of truth. You know, like let's in this context, we've been talking about reincarnation. Okay, it isn't literally a fact that any of us are going to, you know, come back on this plane, you know, as it were, as another human or as an animal or a plant or whatever. Okay, so factually, that's not valid, that idea of reincarnation. But it's not utterly false, even though it's factually invalid. There's a thread of truth in that idea, right? Because in reality, there are a sequence of bodies, that you manifest through. So there's a sequence of lives. It's just that you don't go around in a circle, you know, on this initial mortal plane. You know, and each time around the circle is the next life. You know, you go around once on this plane, and it's a spiral. It's going up. The next time around, it's on a higher level with a higher form. Not the same form or a lesser form, like an animal or a plant. Okay? So, I mean, there is a cycle to it. Right? It's just that it's an ascending spiral. There's a truth there, but it's not factually valid. I mean, everything is like that. Every religious theology, no matter what it is, I mean, the only reason it's endured for any length of time is because basically unrecognized, there are threads of truth in it that you super consciously identify with. Consciously, you're identifying with the things that are facts that aren't. But super consciously, you teach your children and they teach their children, and it goes on for generations, because super consciously there's a resonance with the thread of truth that's embedded down in it. And the fifth epical revelation for the first time is a revelation that's trying to help us with that, help us to penetrate through all our so-called factual fog, right, and find the thread of truth and follow it up and out of the morass of human ignorance, right, and get a religion, for instance, that's reasonable and logical, and hence genuine religion. How could time give me eternity? That's illogical. Right? So no matter how fancy your notion is about time, that's never going to give you eternity. You know, if you have any relationship to eternity, that had to be given to you from the top down. Fancy playing with time doesn't somehow build eternity from the bottom up. But religions all have that scheme in some way or another. You're playing with matter and time, and somehow that transcends itself into eternity and spirit. It's like, no, you have to let go of time and matter in order to grab a hold of spirit and eternity that have been put down to you from the top down. Yeah, that's the kind of stuff we're getting at. I've brought this up many times. It doesn't matter where we're reading in the book. That same basic lesson is always there. You're reading about dual spiritism, or you're reading about atomic physics, or you're reading about paleontology, or you're reading about the life of Jesus. Right? The first thing you want to be trying to do is not memorize some sort of factual disclosure. Right? The first thing you want to be trying to do is penetrate through the words and the immediate factual nature and find the truth that they're trying to get you to recognize there. It takes courage. Okay, I mean, what they're asking you to do is scary on the surface. It sounds like they're making a very ungracious assault on everything you hold dear. I mean, like I said before, it only appears that way. Not really. They're not really assaulting the truth that you hold on to. It's just that the truth you're holding on to, you aren't conscious of that. And it's time for you to do that. Don't hold on to what's been conscious so much. Go deeper. Okay. Little bit more here on Shiva and Vishnu. Notice what they're pointing out again about how some of this is quite recent, even though, as they said up front, this, the oldest and most cosmopolitan of the world's religions. It's like, well, Shiva and Vishnu arose in the first millennium after Christ. Okay? And like I said a little bit ago, I mean, further complexifications happened yesterday, and will happen tomorrow, right? I mean, it's an ongoing complexification. You can just imagine how much Christian missionaries talking about Jesus as God incarnate spun up Vishnu avatar ideas. If anything, having someone totally out of the blue, out of your culture, come in and say, definitely there's incarnation, well, that's that's good tidings of affirmation and joy for your ideas of Vishnu incarnations. You even had the Melchizedek missionaries feeding in the idea to them that there was this incarnate person named Melchizedek. So incarnation, see, is coming forward from Machiavelli Melchizedek. It's getting reinforced by Jesus. And we all know, when Buddhism gets spun up, for many, Buddha becomes another avatar of Vishnu. Yeah, you got some?
Did that cover?
I think I did. I've been kind of watching. Did I cover?
Yeah, I think Vishnu would be easy. So, yeah, it's good. It's just letting the mind absorb it and not getting hooked. Like I have the Nexus.
Yeah.
Like the era is the last comment you made about, you know, the missionaries talking about Christ and God is the same as that, the Aryan thought from a Hindu Brahmin point of view. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to, you know, take a look at the different aspects from my own intellectual mm-hmm.
history. Yeah, and just remember, you know, you're jumping in here, you know, we've already read way back all the first papers of the book that are talking about God the Father in a direct way. You know, here we're, you know, here we're bogged down in all the details of evolutionary religion, and you hear me referring to, okay, you know, the actual nature of God the Father is like, well, what's that? It's like, well, we're not talking about that right here. You know, so it's kind of complicated for you to compare and contrast right now. Yeah, you know? But just recognize that, you know, we're on paper 94, so there's been 93 papers plus the foreword before this, giving lots of detail. I mean, in the first five papers is all about God the Father. And, you know, when all is said and done going through those five papers, if you have the courage to face it, it's like, well, okay, so they just took a big eraser to every thought that I've ever had about God the Father. I mean,
they had a lot of good ones.
It's like, I thought there was a God, and I had a tendency sometimes to call him Father. It's like, well, okay, I got that much, but I needed to really kind of change my definition of the word God, and I needed to change my definition of the word Father. But, you know, and you know, like you've heard me say many times, I mean, one of the most disruptive things, you know, about when all is said and done with you unpacking God the Father in the first five papers. The real God the Father has no outside. Yeah, you know, it just says that point blank. He has no outside, no beyond, right? No past, no future. Right. He has no relationship to time. He has no relationship to space. He doesn't have an outside. It's a being without an outside. It's a being with only an inside. Right? Like I said, in the hourglass analogy, he only has an upper domain. He has no lower domain, no associating mechanism to the outside because he has no outside. Okay? He has no outer life. It's like, well, the God I've always believed in and prayed to is addressing my outer life issues. Not to mention they're my temporal, material issues. So you're telling me the real God has absolutely no relationship to that at all? Yeah.
God the Father.
God the Father. It's like, well, but wait a minute. You can't. There's got to be God out here in time and with matter and with me, you know, intimately. Yeah, but it's not God the Father. Right? There's not just one personalized facet of deity. There's many. God the Son, God the Spirit, God the Sevenfold, God the Supreme, God the Ultimate, God the Absolute, God the Mother, yeah, etc. And you know, and so you know, what you have to do is, you know, we've been trying to make God the Father do all the inside things. It's like, no, God is completely, you know, we're on the outside. He doesn't have, you know, so from our perspective, he's completely outside of where we are. In our outer lives.
Doesn't mean you can't talk to him.
But it doesn't mean you don't have an inner life that you could do like Jesus told you to do and seek first and cultivate a genuine inner life, because your genuine inner life could relate very straightforward directly to a being only has an inner life, don't you think? Right? He, none of his outer life doings is going to fog him, right? He only has an inner life. So if you come to him in your inner life, he's right there. Nothing could distract his attention, right? When you find him there, it's as if you're the only being in existence, right? Right? The real God the Father, right, is glorious. But, you know, if all you're concerned about is free food and free health care, God the Father doesn't deal with those things. okay? You know, and that can be very disillusioning and disappointing and difficult. You know?
He's got angels of hell.
right. But you got to figure out, you know, how all those stuff fits in. What their prime directives are in relating to, and all these sorts of things, right? Yeah.
I like how it just all gets covered with trust.
Right.
You can just trust that you've been provided for.
Yeah.
And that there isn't a difficulty that doesn't have a right adjustment somewhere in your purview by that technique that you've just laid out.
Yeah. And how that gets us right back to Hinduism.
Thank you.
When all is said and done, like I've been saying about Hinduism, it's like it has this infinite complexity of wheels within wheels within wheels within wheels. Wait a minute. Let me step back and reflect on that. That's telling me when all is said and done, I'm not feeling trust. When humans are, you know, trying to micromanage the whole picture and, you know, have an infinite number of I's to dot and T's to cross, it doesn't sound like trust to me. They're flailing, desperately trying to convince themselves that they shouldn't go catatonic with fear. How about if you just fear not? How about if you start with trust? And you don't need to know any physics. You don't need to know any of the facets of deity. You don't need to know all the different fims, omnia fims, superna fims, seraphim, cherub. Yeah, you don't need to know any of that stuff. Right? You don't need to know ultimatonic physics. You don't need, right? How about if you just start with trust and know that even though you're this almost completely ignorant little child of God, there's a God who loves you absolutely, and no real harm can befall you. Period. What else do you need? Right? As a child of God, you don't need anything else. Just use your faith grasp to take a hold of that fact that God loves you absolutely.
It doesn't mean you say don't do nothing.
But you start there. Right. And
your way, to me, it means the way you approach things is different.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you don't approach things. You don't approach the whole rest of, you know, listening as a human and everything. It just gives you a whole different perspective. To where, if you say, there's a fear not aspect of it, and there's, you know, a joyful aspect of it.
It's got to make your approach better.
Yeah.
It's got to be able to step up your game and refocus and, you know, reconsecrate and, you know, all these kinds of things.
If climate is going to challenge us, do you think we'll be successful if we're infinitely fearful? I don't think so. Right? How about if we start with what Jesus told you to do? Fear not. Okay, that's not happening on the planet. Everyone is fearing more every day. Our children don't even sleep at night anymore because we have them so filled with fear. Right? We're driving them as far away from what Jesus told you to do as step one as we can drive our children. That's called child abuse. Okay? I mean, it is so wrong what we're doing. No, fear not. Trust. No real harm can befall you. Okay? It doesn't matter if all earthly things crash. No real harm can befall you. Death is not real harm. Death is just actual harm, temporal actuality. Right? It doesn't affect your relationship to eternity one iota.
Don't do the salubrious thing in the tree, though.
Right. But if you start with that solidity, okay, now, like John is saying, okay, you're not supposed to just, you know, find a palm tree to lay under, okay? Right, the point is now go out in the world and see if you can humbly engage some things predicated on fear not. Right? Right? Try voting predicated on fear not instead of fear, 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 fear. And see how that, you know, will change the way our government of the people, by the people, for the people plays out. Right? That's not, you can't have government by and for the people if the people are blobs of fear. That's not going to work. You're going to need some monarch again, right? That stands courageously on his white horse and at the lead of the charge or whatever. I mean, yeah, right. you can't have democracy.
No,
the feeble.
That's absurd.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, you can see how, I mean, we could just go on and on. I mean, if you start with a nugget of truth, it expands into a discussion of everything in a very immediate, straightforward way. Yeah. Yeah, did you have something?
We were in a coffee shop today in Meadows, a Big Daddy coffee shop,
mm-hmm.
and we saw this old Manhattan middle school kids,
mm-hmm.
and they had loudspeakers, and,
right.
and they were having fun, and because they were out of school, and they didn't stay out of school for, I mean, they didn't see any fear, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I saw some fear because my bicycle was on top of my bicycle.
Yeah.
Shelf. Anyway, so I didn't see.
Yeah, I mean, sure, but yeah, when they're out there, but you know, listen to them talk about how,
yeah.
you know, a lot of them, you know, really, you know, wake up you know, with nightmares, you know, because they think the world is going to end tomorrow, and you know, and it's driving them to nihilism. You know, what's the point? You know, many are deciding that they shouldn't have children because. The earth is going to end anyway. So, I mean, it's a very empty, sad road. Right? Where's hope? Where's faith?
Right? Where's God?
Where's God? Right? Where's God? Right? When you get rid of God and you try to use man as a substitute, humanism, you're going to have a lot of nihilistic children. Okay, off my soapbox. Back to the Trimurti. So it starts with those three like they're saying. You got four descending levels. This is the next notch down from the formless. Okay, what's next in complexity of forms?
We didn't really talk about Shiva, did we?
Oh well, it's just kind of right there.
Okay.
The Lord of life and death, God of fertility and master of destruction, especially the last part, you know, destroyer. You have creator, destroyer, and you know, preserver, maintainer, upholder, whatever you want to say for Vishnu.
Three, Vedic and post-Vedic deities. Many of the ancient gods of the Aryans, such as Agni, Indra, Soma, have persisted as secondary to the three members of the Trimurti. Numerous additional gods have arisen since the early days of Vedic India, and these have also been incorporated into the Hindu pantheon.
So, yeah, you're continuing to carry along a polytheistic complexity down at level three here. And notice, though, that, and again, this you were asking about. When you go back to any of the ancient Indo-European peoples, be it those in the Indus Valley or the Greeks or whomever, you have a commonality of what is andite deity concepts. And remember they talked about Agni and Indra before. But first, notice we've lost Dios Pitar. Right? That one's not mentioned. I mean, you know, occasionally it's dabbled with in Hinduism, but that Sky Father, you know, and the Sky Father is very common, you know, be it the Greeks, you know, the Greeks have their Sky Father Zeus, the Romans have their Sky Father Jupiter, right? I mean, you could go on and on and on. Any of those peoples have a Sky Father. But we've kind of lost that Andite Sky Father that you could move towards the Universal Father, you know, the genuine Universal Father. And that's not surprising because item number one is the formless Brahman, you know, the impersonal. So it's not surprising that you know, he might kind of get lost in the shuffle, the Sky Father. Anyone who knows about Hinduism, you know, Agni and Indra still have their devotees. Like we pointed out, Agni has had a tendency to go from three heads to two heads to one head. So to go from having fire, lightning, and the sun, right, earth, atmosphere, sky, right, threefoldness, you know, down to just fire, brought him down to earth with just one head. But he had the sun, remember there? You know, well, what about the moon? Well, that's Soma. Soma is the moon. You know, so a moon deity concept, lowercase d deity, right? And then, like they said, I mean, you know, there's sort of an endless plethora of others too. You know, and any time they've gotten any sort of strong association with some other people, there's a tendency for that god to drift into their pantheon. I mean, but you know, the only other peoples that are so polyglot like this about in their religion is the Tibetan Buddhists, you know, that sort of assimilate everything that they come upon too into a big complicated hodgepodge. All right, so that's down, you know, down on, and what's down on the lowest level here?
Four, the demigods, supermen, semigods, heroes, demons, ghosts, evil spirits, sprites, monsters, goblins, and saints of the later day cults.
Okay, so in other words, et cetera. Yeah, just you name it. And notice how they purposely have kind of a lot of different flavors, you know. I mean, they talk to Christians and they get the notion of saints, and boy, you know, so saints get into play, and you know, it just everything gets assimilated. You know, even giving you names, it's like, well, what's the difference between a demon and an evil spirit and a goblin? It's like, yeah, again. It, you know, different peoples, Hindu peoples, have different flavors and play things different ways with different words. This is very complicated. We don't want to poke at the Hindus too hard here. Because there's a lot of Christians, for instance, that get off on this endless complexity of tangents, you know, hierarchies of angels, and Jews have hierarchies of angels, you know, especially if you kind of go beyond the sort of immediate centralized, you know, version of Judaism or Christianity, you know, you get into some of the more mystical endeavors on the peripheries and you know, you get all kinds of complexities too, because you blend in all of this stuff that you're picking up from the environment.
Yeah, if you talk about complexity, you read your angel book.
Yeah.
There's more angels than you can stick a stick at for all different kinds of things.
That was exactly what I was going to bring up next. But even then, it's like, should we really poke too much fun at that? See, there's a thread of truth in number four. Yeah. Okay, there aren't literally goblins, okay, and stuff, okay. But there's a vague recognition that the universe is really complicated. I mean, there's more types of beings than we can imagine numerically, let alone the number of beings. Right, you think this is a long list. Okay, I mean, remember, they say that the offspring of the infinite spirit, just, you know, the third person, there's more types of offspring of the infinite spirit than, you know, it's beyond your numerical concept. Just the number of types of beings. Completely beyond your numerical concept. It's like, well, I can go to Googleplex and stuff. It's like, well, okay, it's really beyond your numerical concept. Right. You know, especially if you don't think of things just from your biased point of view of a finite being in time, if you go to the cosmos infinite, right? I mean, there's obviously an infinite number of types of beings in the cosmos infinite. Googleplex is not going to do it. Okay? there's a thread of truth there. It's not totally stupid, superstitious primitiveness that we have all this stuff. Right? Plus, of course, we know, you literally had, until the Pentecost, you had evil spirits and demons and, rebel midwayers and rebel angels and stuff. And, people knew about that. And, that just kind of fostered this sort of immediacy of this. But there's a thread of truth. The universe has a lot of complexity. There's a vast hierarchy. Okay? And the more you go down, the more the numbers of beings multiply. Okay? Yeah.
So I was just thinking, so another concept of study is demigod for me, because mm-hmm. I don't know what it is. but I think in the application of trying to understand, I'm looking at it like Halloween. So for Halloween to take place with all these different beings, it might be angel or they might be other, there has to be the process of death, and we have to be looking at people dying and coming and going. Yeah. Right? I mean, this room, we're all human. There's no one here that's a demigod, and we can't
take people
out. Right? Is that
correct? Yeah, they're kind of sort of using demigod in kind of a quotes there. I mean, they're, when you hear me say the ghost cult, I mean, evolutionary religion started with people taking their dreams as being real and deciding that they were having an experience with another plane of existence, the ghost plane. It's like, I'm having a dream about our chief that died, so the chief must not have really died. I'm engaging his ghost. That's ghostland. That dreamland isn't just dreamland, it's ghostland. And then as time went on, they got the idea that ghosts evolve, and eventually they evolve into spirits. And they evolve, and those spirits evolve in a hierarchy to higher and higher spirits. So eventually there was a highest spirit that they called God. Right? So that's the ghost cult evolutionary religion that starts with extrapolating humans into ghosts after death.
So do you think it comes from the root of Catholicism then?
Catholicism is very recent. I mean, that stuff goes back a million years. Right? I mean, the ideas of ghosts and stuff is very ancient.
Yeah. Like
right. So, I mean, all evolutionary religions are playing off of that starting point. I mean, Christians, some still call the third person of their Christian Trinity the Holy Ghost. Right? See, in other words, they're saying that one is kind of most like a human that you evolve all the way up into a very transcendent Holy Ghost. It's a very anthropomorphic bottom-up concept. When I'm talking about the infinite spirit, the third person, that has nothing to do with bottom up. Right? That starts at the infinite level, of top down. But here, notice they have demigods, and then as one of these, they say semi-gods. It's like, well, what's the difference between a demigod and a semi-god? It's the difference between Greek and Latin. They both mean half. See, literally a demigod or a semi-god is a half-god. In other words, like when Zeus would come down and have sex with some human woman, and she would give birth to Hercules, Hercules is a demigod because he's half man, half god. Exactly. Think about how, in Christianity, Jesus is believed to have been born of a virgin. See, that's just the whole Zeus thing again. You're just, instead of saying Zeus came down and had sex with Mary, you're saying the Holy Ghost came down and had sex with Mary, right, and made a demigod. See, that's just the old ghost cult sort of stuff. Of thinking that great people like Jesus, in their mythologies that spin up from their lives, were born of a virgin. You just take the nasty bits out, that St. Augustine definitely wouldn't have liked. We don't want to visualize Zeus having sex with a human female or something. All right, so let's just make it all mystical, you know, where some spirit force, you know, impregnates her instead of Zeus turning into a snake or something that's just, oh, that's just so primitive and grotesque. All right. See, but again, it's just, we can't, we can't get past these very primitive ideas. Right? No, it's really cool physics. Joseph had sex with Mary just like every human man has sex with every human woman. Okay? Sperm and egg came together in her womb as a single-celled human. And then the really cool physics begins. A being from on high, his energy system, you know, incarnates within that physical energy system. And he's together as one with it from single-celled conception forward. You know, and this is such cool physics because it's not front door physics. I mean, there's no way to understand incarnation. There's no way to get the energy of a creator son to meet face to face with, you know, a single celled human conception, right? The two, you know, do not meet. One is way above and one is way below. But if you go around the back, right, you know, if you start with spirit and go all the way around, you find matter through the back door. Spirit can't find matter through the front door. They don't meet at all. Right? I mean, the mystery of incarnation is this incredible mystery of, and they tell you that you should think of about things in an ellipse instead of a line. Right, so that there's two ways to get at a point. You can go the forward way or you can go the back way. Right, it's kind of like when I was saying you can start with the first source and center, you could start with what we call the third source and center and make that the first thing. Right, start with the mother side, as it were, instead of starting with the father side. Neither one is really first. Right. They're co-equal, you know, facts. Many things I've said tonight are blasphemy, right, to many, you know, or at least an abomination, and certainly are disrespectful, okay, are certainly nothing that Jesus would have ever said. You know, like I've tried to point out, you know, the fifth epical revelation is not for timid souls like Jesus was engaging, trying to get them to bring some genuine spirit into their timid soul material life. You know, and he was being very gentle and gracious in general with them. Occasionally he was pretty hard with one of his apostles behind the scenes, you know, but right to the masses, no, he was right. He didn't, like I said, he didn't walk up to some struggling person, you know, lying in the gutter, you know, and say, "Your prayer is an abomination to God." But you're reading them in the Urantia book, and it's like, not only does it talk about prayer as we think of it as an abomination to the paradise deities, but it doesn't say that somewhere up in like the first part when they're talking about God the Father. No, the places where they talk about abomination, it's in the Jesus papers. Right? I mean, it's so different. Right? And they're not trying to be ruthless and cruel. They're not trying to talk to someone that they shouldn't be so forward with. They're trying to talk to courageous and independent cosmic thinkers who are ready to let go of the whole falderall that they've been trying to find meaning in for their whole life and say, why are you trying to find meaning where meaning can't be found? Just erase it all. Let go of it all. You don't need all that silliness that humans have invented. Let's start fresh with reality. You'll find it's rock solid. It's perfectly reasonable. It's perfectly logical. Right? And it literally can be taken a hold of with genuine faith grasp. Right? Your faith can be real instead of an illusion. Well, I'm pretending really earnestly that I'm holding on to something, but I kind of don't think I really am. Right? Because I'm still pretty fearful.
And we need a caveat.
Yep.
About prayer.
And of course, yeah, every time I bring a prayer, you know, we spend a whole paper on prayer because of how problematic that is, you know, to try to talk about prayer with any objectivity. Because prayer, more than almost anything else, is extremely important in all of its primitiveness. Even the most primitive, ignorant, superstitious prayer is extremely important to a budding child of God and to the evolution of primitive man. Without it, it doesn't work. It's the only way that you can get a very fearful little child, be they just you developing out of the womb or someone, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago. It's the only way to get them forward, you know, is with that basic programming to pray in a very temporal, material way. It's not evil to do that. It's just how you get started. And eventually, when you can mature, you do mature. And like even the Apostle Paul said, despite all of his ignorance and blind spots, even the Apostle Paul knew that when you mature, you leave the childish things behind. You know, it's okay for the child to pray for a parking space. But not adults of God don't pray for parking spaces. I mean, come on. But it's better than not praying at all. Again, initially, it doesn't matter. You can pray to whatever.
Doesn't matter.
But just recognize, you know, just if nothing else, know that you will continue to mature. God is growing you. And you'll pray differently in the future. That doesn't make the way you're praying now bad. But you'll pray better in the future. It's good now in its context. It just gets better and better and better. God made you that way. So it's good. Even though it's an ignorant, primitive child. Okay, it's still good. Just look forward to it maturing. You know, and when you're ready, you can look in the book and they give you some hints about where it's going. And you might even kind of start looking for where it would go, where it's less about you. You know, because, you know, if you mature at all, it starts to feel a little weird to pray as selfishly as you used to. Just it's like, oh, this feels a little bit weird. Maybe I should like at least pray for others instead of myself so much. You know, you mature.
So you mature no matter to whom you pray. So it could be Krishna or Indra or
It all starts that way, and humans would collapse. If the Hindus that pray to Vishnu couldn't pray to Vishnu, their whole culture would collapse. Right? It's how we stay together. I mean, if we can't turn to prayer, most of us would just give up. Right? I mean, it's what holds us together, keeps us sane. Right?
Collective psychological procedure.
Right. But again, you know, of all human knowledge, that which is the greatest value is to know the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it. One of the things that you can recognize as you read through Jesus' life, he started out praying and praying a lot when he was young, and as he matured, he eventually transcended all that. Right? Because he was moving from prayer through thanksgiving to worship. Right? And he turned to that transcendent fact of worship as an adult of God, or as a child of God, he turned to prayer. right? You know, and the degree to which he, you know, prayer was in the latter part of his life, it was, you know, it was just, remember, he even says at times, okay, this isn't really me praying. You know, he would say, I'm just modeling this for the people that are listening to me because they're still children of God, and I need to help them to, you know, with to improve their prayer life, you know, so I'm kind of just modeling it for them. You know, or, you know, life hit him with so many sledgehammers and kind of pounded him down back to that child of God state where he needed to pray again to kind of climb the ladder back up again.
So the next level, thank, does it matter if you thank God or thank you Jesus or thank you Krishna?
No,
it's another level.
It does. It just, yeah, just keep moving on. See, you know, moving from, you know, feeling you need to pray because of some hole you're in, some in, you know, indebtedness or whatever, to praying because you recognize the gifts of your life. You know, you give thanksgiving for the gifts and not praying for the deficits to be filled. Right? I mean, you know, I've got no money, but I have a fragment of infinity that lives within my mind.
Yes.
It's more important. Okay? So I need to pray for money? No. How about if I give thanks for the infinite gift that the Father has given me? Right? And just trust that it'll be okay. What's the worst that could happen to me? I could die. That's just, and that's
big deal.
And it's no big deal. Everybody dies. I got to die of something.
Maybe it'll be fun.
Right? Fear not. Right? You know, as the book says, if you have the courage to remember the words, death is a technique. Right.
I've waited all my life.
Okay, let's get back to.
I'm just looking this up here.
Oh.
After the three had aroused from their slumber, the master again went apart by himself,
mm-hmm.
and falling down on the ground, again prayed,
yep.
Father, I know if it is possible to avoid this cup. So at the very end.
Yeah, like I said, I mean, like I said, when things, you know, it pounded him really down, he needed to do it again. Start with that foundational prayer. He was using it to climb the ladder back up to thanksgiving, to worship, right? I mean, yeah. I mean, in this life, in that life, perforce, Jesus served two masters. The material master can be the primary thing in play, and you've got to use prayer to help you back up out of that depression, you know, of material gravity, right? I mean, prayer is extremely important as a psychological procedure. See, he needed to proceed out of that beset state, and prayer is how you can proceed. But if you move up as a psychological procedure, eventually you've transcended the need for it to be a psychological procedure, and it can take on a new role as a spiritual technique, something that helps you attune to the other substance, not something that's helping you to proceed in the face of the really draggy material substance that's, you know, shackled around your ankles.
The other thing I was going to say when you wouldn't let me go on.
No, okay. There I go again.
That was like half an hour ago. was that I have a lot of friends who are Krishnas, you know, basically. And a lot of us who grew up in Boulder, you know, around, there was a lot of Krishnas, you know, they were at the airport all the time.
Right.
And, of course, there were Americans who turned into Krishnas, so to speak, but their attitude towards Brahma or towards God is not anymore as much of a person-less God. In other words, God has more, is become more of a person to them. In other words, it's not quite like it's portrayed here, so to speak. I'm not quite so sure how it is with people, you know, who start out with just Hinduism and have never had Western culture God, personality God.
Yeah, I mean, it's so obvious.
It seems that evolution is moving them a little bit into, well, there's got to be more to this than it.
Exactly. Yeah, and their exposure to Christianity, kind of like I was saying, Steve Foster's that. It's like, wait a minute, I think it's Krishna, because he's very Christ-like.
Right.
see, in a number of ways. And yeah, and so it's an easy, you know, if you're coming from a Western culture, that's a fairly straightforward transition. If you've decided the whole Christianity thing is this white man's religion, it's kind of weird. Christian is a great substitute. And yeah, see, and that's, you know, notice the four descending levels. But if you think about it, it's like, well, wait a minute. As I go down in these levels, I actually get something that's more personalized. Am I really descending? Or maybe I'm kind of backing into something that... So is it really... I mean, see, it's actually a step forward for them to go all the way down and to, you know, through Vishnu to Krishna and then turn around and say, you know, I think I want to put this personal thing up on top.
And that's what they do.
Right, and Brahma starts to fade away and stuff. And yeah, see, yeah, and the Buddhists, you know, as we'll read when we go through Buddhism, you know, they've gone through that same process too. You know, in certain lines of Buddhism, slowly beginning to distill a more personal, individuated God concept. You know, in the northern traditions of Buddhism, the southern traditions, you know, not so much. Okay, but in the northern traditions, you can kind of do like the Krishnas are doing. See, and you're getting back to something that could be evolved forward into the universal Father.
Chris,
yeah, yep.
This is interesting. The Hare Krishnas refer to Krishna as the personality of Godhead.
Yeah, see, just what I'm saying,
also,
right?
Also, the other thing is that according to Prabhupada, which is Swami Prabhupada, who founder of the Krishna consciousness, Christ is Krishna.
Yeah.
The same word.
We're about to read that. It's coming up here. Yeah, exactly. Like it's obvious that Christ is going to get, you know, identified into this scheme because it's just so close. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, let's keep going here.
While Hinduism has long failed to vivify the Indian people, at the same time, it has usually been a tolerant religion. Its great strength lies in the fact that it has proved to be the most adaptive, amorphic religion to appear on Urantia. It is capable of almost unlimited change and possesses an unusual range of flexible adjustment from the high and semi-monotheistic speculations of the intellectual Brahmin to the errant fetishism and primitive cult practices of the debased and depressed classes of ignorant believers.
Yeah, like, you know, feeding milk to a statue or a rock or something, you know, errant fetishism. Right? Okay, notice the word in the middle there.
I meant to say, or believing in evolution, Catholic, you have to balance it.
Again, I'm not poking, all these religions have their issues, just we're reading about Hinduism right now. But notice in the middle, they're amorphic. Mm-hmm. Right, morphe is Greek for what?
Form.
Form, yes. Right. Without form, amorphic. So I wonder why it has proved to be the most adaptive, amorphic religion to appear on Urantia. Oh, do you suppose it could be because it all kind of starts with the formless Brahman? Mm-hmm. See, of course. See, so the in and of itself, that formless has all kinds of issues. But you carry that forward, sort of the essence of that, even if you've kind of left the Brahman behind and you're really focusing on Krishna, say, or whatever... you know, there's kind of this quote-unquote spirit of that that's still in play. And so it's this adaptive, amorphic religion, which, if nothing else, at least can be tolerant. Right? How tolerant is it? Run-of-the-mill Christian, you know, at times, you know, not very. How tolerant are, you know, is the run-of-the-mill Muslim? Okay, a lot of times not very, you know.
It's kind of funny because it was born out of the intolerance of the priests.
Yes, of course. See, and that just shows you how the Supreme Mind takes everything that we do. It'll take our intolerance and then turn it unwittingly, in terms of the humans, into a manifestation of tolerance. Right? It takes everything to goodness. Right? The evolutionary process, right, of God the Mother evolves everything forward.
Krishna has a form, you know.
Yeah, and that yeah, he, and exactly.
His
yeah.
family, his brother,
exactly.
sister.
Like I said, it's going down to more and more form.
I wonder if Brahma also has a form, doesn't he?
What?
Brahma.
Yeah. See. Yeah. Yeah. Remember that. You know, the Trimurti means three forms.
Yeah. So he has also.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
They depict
their
statue.
And like we were saying, it starts with formless. It gets to, you know, kind of the first level of form, a little bit fuzzy, but some form with Brahma, Shiva, and Vishnu. And then as you go down to avatars or down another notch, okay, the form gets all the more definitive. See, and you're going to have a reality response to that. It's like, wait a minute, I think God is literal, is a form. It's not some formless concept. No, God is an individuality. I don't know where he stands, but he's got to be standing somewhere. Right? And, yeah, you know, there's a location. You know, so you will gravitate to those concepts that have more form, even if they're very anthropomorphic. Okay? It's just like I start out inescapably as an individual, right? I'm a physical individuality. Why? Because my personality is absolutely unique. And there's no place for my absolutely unique personality to identify in a formless continuum. There has to be an individuality for it to identify with, for its absolute uniqueness to have a potential to manifest through. Right? Absolute uniqueness can't manifest in the midst of blurred, you know, homogeneously together of a whole bunch of other absolute uniqueness. That's illogical. Right? So, I mean, so we naturally gravitate to a more individuated God concept. You know, sure, because of Brahmanism in India, you know, you have these Eastern concepts that fuzzed everything out. But they can't stay fuzzed out forever. As the centuries roll on, whether you're in China or in India, form starts to coalesce out of the formless void. And more people identify with that definitive individuated form rather than some formless philosophic concept. Right?
Yes. Krishna stands in Vrindavana.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Also, Islam came to end all the forms, you know, so any kind of form is illegal there. You know,
yeah, there's all these issues, you know. Anyway, let's keep going here. Let's see, what else do we have there? Urine fetishism, amorphic. The other thing up front. While Hinduism has long failed to vivify the Indian people. Okay, I mean, we don't want to forget that. Like they pointed out, that, you know, this is a difficulty. It's you know, it got so lifeless. You know, and it's like we were just saying, evolution tries to bring life back into it, okay, and it is, but it's been a struggle. You know, if there's always kind of a nagging sense of that the universe really, or not the universe, your individuality really has no purpose, that you, the drop of water, is just going to blend back into the ocean. You know, that just sucks the life out of your sense of self. Okay, and so you know, but evolution will slowly move any peoples out of such a lifeless philosophy into something that's, you know, enlightened again.
Yeah, they gave you that right back to back with describing it with great strength.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
kind of fun.
Right. And again, it's like I said, don't focus on. Everything is just a negative, wanting fact. Everything has a thread of truth flowing through it. That's why the Supreme Mind can take anything forward, right? Use your insight. Penetrate through. Sure, It takes no intellect to figure out what something isn't. Chris isn't perfect. Okay, that's not news. Okay? What is Chris? Okay? Not what is Chris not. Okay? When you say it to yourself, I'm not, you know, you just have a long adding machine paper list of I'm not this, I'm not this, I'm not this, I fall short here, I fall short here, right? Or do you approach yourself positively?
A perfectionist.
Right?
Yeah, there's the I'm imperfect.
You're not you. Factually.
I'm perfecting
yeah,
you.
Factually, you're imperfect, but in truth, you're perfecting. Yeah. Yeah. We're not going to finish this paper. The section, maybe. Okay.
It's on the negative side of my list.
All right, let's keep going.
Hinduism has survived because it is essentially an integral part of the basic social fabric of India. It has no great hierarchy which can be disturbed or destroyed. It is interwoven into the life pattern of the people. It has an adaptability to changing conditions that excels all other cults, and it displays a tolerant attitude of adoption toward many other religions, Gautama Buddha and even Christ himself being claimed as incarnations of Vishnu.
See, I told you it was coming up. All right. Right, I mean, it's just, I mean, So obvious that they would interpret what the Christian missionaries were saying is, another avatar of Vishnu.
How convenient.
Yeah.
Right.
Remember, you know, a lot of people can think of Catholicism, you know, as a flavor of Christianity, as in some ways being very intolerant and rigid. Okay, but you know, much more so than you know any Protestant sect, Catholicism is like Hinduism, right? I mean, it goes into a new part of the world and assimilates whatever's there. I mean, it started, you know, by assimilating Mithraism and the cult of the Great Mother, right? It goes to Central and South America and assimilates all that stuff, and the missionaries say, yeah, you know, you've got this idea of a female deity like thing. That's Mary, and so right, it just assimilates everything. Right, I mean, and so it's this very complicated thing, and Catholicism's not monolithic at all. There's all kinds of there's those that are really into Mary, and those that are very not, and etc. It's all better than nihilism, right? At least there's some God concept, even if it's very primitive, that the God of evolution can evolve forward, right? You can't get something from nothing. If someone is genuinely nihilistic and has embraced nothingness, there's nothing that the God of evolution can evolve forward. Not even the universal Father, as an infinite creator, can create something out of nothing, right? Creating is transforming, right? A stuff that we temporally call a potentiality into a stuff that we temporally call an actuality, right? He's morphing, right? He's changing forms is what he's doing as a creator. He's not making something out of nothing. That's impossible. That's illogical. No one can make something out of nothing.
Nothing had nothing to do with it. Okay. Where does something that he starts with come from?
Oh, you temporally biased Mer. Okay, keep going.
Today in India, the great need is for the portrayal of the Jesusonian gospel, the fatherhood of God and the sonship and subsequent brotherhood of all men, which is personally realized in loving ministry and social service. In India, the philosophical framework is existent. The cult structure is present. All that is needed is the vitalizing spark of the dynamic love portrayed in the original gospel of the Son of Man, divested of the Occidental dogmas and doctrines which have tended to make Michael's life bestowal a white man's religion.
Okay, that's all pretty straightforward. I want you to just notice one little technical thing that's important. So it says, today in India, the great need is for the portrayal of the Jesusonian gospel, the fatherhood of God and the sonship and consequent brotherhood of all men. Fatherhood is capitalized. Okay. So, you know, you read that and you think, oh, if I go to part four, okay, where it talks about the fatherhood of God and the sonship and consequent brotherhood of all men, okay, but nowhere in part four is fatherhood capitalized. Okay, all the times that fatherhood is capitalized is in, you know, before part four.
Fathers.
And most of the non-capitalized fatherhoods are in part four. Okay, why? And why is it capitalized here specifically? Because by capitalizing it, you're directly suggesting that the person think about deity, capital D deity, like the Father, capital F, that facet of deity that's called the Father, that you think about not just kind of an anthropomorphic individuality or something that's sort of you're playing off of your biologic father so directly with. You know, so don't go bottom up from your biologic father to this fatherhood of God, lowercase f. Start top down with the facet of deity, the capital F, Father. Okay, why here? Because we've just been seeing, unlike almost anyone else, that Romantic philosophy was, you know, because they were depersonalizing, but not totally erasing everything, we're kind of getting a budding deity concept going. All right? They're just reminding you that if you wanted to approach them more effectively, you know, you need to kind of approach fatherhood from the unity perspective, you know, the unity viewpoint, instead of the individuality viewpoint that a kind of a Christian Western sort of person would. Approach it more from the unity viewpoint. So it's capital F Father. So then you can go, well, what do you mean, Chris? Yeah, well, see, that's something for you to just start reflecting on. Capitalize and uncapitalize is super important in the Urantia book. Like I was saying, I mean, it's in this sense, it's very, very directly opposite. Instead of bottom up, it's top down. Okay? And see, to approach them in a way where they have on-ramps. See, that's what they're saying. You know, it turned into this white man's religion where the Hindu mind has no on-ramps into it. You need to approach them in a more deity, more unity viewpoint way, and not such an anthropomorphic, you know, Western individuality way. Yeah? That's what they're getting at there.
Arabs, whites, men, or
well, you know, it's kind of quote, you know, in other words, European. You know, like, you know, remember they were specific here, right there at the end, divested of the Occidental dogmas. Right, yeah.
There's a lot of language.
Yeah, yeah, and there's a lot of very dark skinned people that have been totally inculcated into Occidental dogmas and doctrines. Okay,
So in the next sentence, what is the philosophical framework that is existing?
What I was just referring to. I mean, the very fact that they capitalized fatherhood is referring to that. That whole section number three, mm-hmm. Romantic philosophy, they have shades of deity concepts like the supreme that you can work with.
And the cult structure is the Brahman structure you're talking about? Those two together.
Just that they.
To me, this particular paragraph is very meaningful.
Yeah.
If
kind of giving you a hint at, you know, how you would approach people in the Hinduist situation. With,
I mean, by the cult structure is present, they mean, I mean, that's one of the problems in the United States, for instance, or, you know, it's really a problem in Europe, is, you know, it's both the Western civilization losing the cult structure, right? And remember, it's that more sixth adjutant energized addition to mere society that makes it a culture, you know, and a culture has a has an evolutionary religious nucleus that is a cult, you know. In other words, a conceptualization nucleus that is fueled by that religious impulse of your sixth adjutant, right? They definitely have that. I mean, you know, there's a flavor of Hindu religion for every person. I mean, they're like, you know, like cult is everywhere, right? Try to approach the Hindus, you know, in a not in a deculted way. You know, I mean, that's impossible, right? They're just, you know, marinating in cult. So you have all of that fired up. I mean, in other words, it's easier to go to India and get them going towards a personal God than it is to go to Europe, because there's no cult structure amongst most Europeans anymore that you can work with. They've just completely, you know, devitalized themselves, you know, and they're becoming, it's just becoming a museum, right? But no, India is energized. It just needs this encouragement to take their basic philosophic concepts and that religious impulse energy, that cult structure, and power it forward, right? Give it that missing, living, personal aspect, like they're saying that it's having a hard time finding. But, you know, even if none of us do that, that which we might do in kind of a revelatory way and are fail to do, evolution will achieve. Like we were talking, even without any of us doing anything, you know, any Christian really doing anything effective for 2,000 years or anything, no Melchizedek missionaries or whatever.
So
they're evolving towards something that's moving again.
Basically saying that the whole concept of, you know, that you're a son of God.
Yes, they're going to...
something that they don't know it, but they're really waiting for here. That would really fit right into their whole...
Keep lifting Krishna up to a more and more exalted concept. He's going to become a father concept in a very definitive way, and you're going to start to see yourself as a child of that father. I mean, it's there. It just needs to be, you know, or it could be encouraged forward. Now, notice what they say. All that is needed is a vitalizing spark of the dynamic love portrayed, right? You know, love. You know, if love is just a feeling to you, okay, you're not going to go there with intense feelings and revivify them. Okay, you got to have a genuine love, personal realization of divine fellowship. If you go there as the embodiment of the personal realization of divine fellowship, and the fruits of that spiritual fact within you are pouring out, right, you will be a revivifying influence amongst those people. Going there with some, you know, Western dogmas is not going to do anything, you know. And turning part four into a dogmatic Jesusism is not going to do it either. Right? It's all going to come off as white man's religion again.
And parts one and two.
Yeah, you need the, you know, like I was saying, I mean, they capitalized F because... they're trying to remind you of the first section of the book is deity. Second section is God. Right? And they have the essence of that deity thing. Right? All of their God concepts, no matter how seemingly anthropomorphic, like they're just trying to point out in this section, have kind of a deity complexity or intangibility to them. You know, they try to portray that in various ways artistically with, you know, what things that God is holding or what color the God is or something. You know, there's these augmentations that they're trying to represent of some sort of a functioning. You know, it isn't just a being that's going to, you know, as a physical form, going to, you know, pick up cups, and, you know, they're more than that. They're trying to say that there's something about them that you can't really see. There's an internal dynamic functioning nature. See, deity functions. They have that concept. It's not just a person acting like it is more in a Western religion. It's more like a deity embodied within them, and that deity has a functioning. See, they have that concept. And you can, I mean, just telling them, yeah, you've got the beginnings of it. You have the idea that the proper definition of the word God is personalized deity. Right? You've got the deity thing. Now just all the more definitively personalize that. You will be head and shoulders above Western people that are still trying to struggle. Okay? See, it's kind of like, you know, if you think about going up in the hourglass analogy, you start in a very individuality mode down at the bottom, and as you move up, you get some initial relationship to unity. Western religion has tended to kind of stay down there in the anthropomorphic level of the flesh. Eastern thinkers moved up a little bit. And you start to get a more direct sense of that unity.
That's because they're not drinking the blood and eating.
Right.
Yeah.
But what they fail to do is, it's like, okay, now keep going. See, because if you take the next step up,
yeah,
instead of just being fuzzed out in that unity will re-individuate in a transcendent unity. Right? So instead of arguing about should we be just blissing in unity or should we be just playing with simplistic flesh-like anthropomorphisms. No, the Eastern people had the first step. Follow them up, bring in some definite unity. Now keep going and re-individuate it.
Didn't you mean a transcendent individuality?
Did I say something else? Yeah. I mean, transcendent of that unity is a transcendent individuality. Yeah, re-individuate it.
You actually can become the son of Krishna. But then you become a demigod, super, and you become kind of eternal,
you know, just space. See, but just to try to get away from it, ending up kind of back into the, you know, into ghost land and stuff like that. You know, see, you know, to not let it be drugged down by the ghost cult ideas. Okay.
So, how does your universe career, which Grandchild is so, you know, definitive about, seems like that would sort of fit right in to understanding. Of course, it's different for them, I would imagine, because of the whole reincarnation aspect.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, you know, I would think that, you know, that particular part of the world or in India would be ripe for a lot of the teachings out of the Revelation, if, you know, even if they have to read them and learn, figure them out like you did.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? But mm-hmm. They got thinkers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and being able to do that and be able to move forward.
And they speak English.
I don't know, do you think...
And they speak English, yeah.
Yeah, well,
yeah. They can actually read the Urantia book in English. Thanks to the British Empire.
Yeah, well, nowadays everybody's, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's kind of interesting. Anyway,
yeah, well, yeah, you know, I mean, it's so close to 9:30. Let's just not get into section 5. Let's not go from India to China. Let's not move to China yet. Let's just talk this out a little bit more.
They're not ready to come to the table yet.
You know, to your point, kind of just, you know, thinking about this last paragraph some more. You know, that's why I was emphasizing way back when we were reading it here, you know, how much difficulty the Melchizedek missionaries had. Don't put on your rose-colored glasses. I mean, you know, you need to face the facts that the same challenges that the Melchizedek missionaries met with, you know, are facing anyone that's trying to play off of this final soaring thought in this paragraph. You've got a massive dragging load of all of that primitive stuff that no matter how much you try to bring enlightenment in there, there's going to be this tendency for it to get pulled down. The whole planet has this issue that is, you know, we've talked about this many times. How do we resolve this? See, a normal world, you know, like we've talked about, is the bell curve of, you know, variations in humanity on a normal world is very tight. You know, and that very tight, narrow bell curve is very slowly and methodically moved forward by revelatory influences, you know, to light and life. That bell curve didn't get tightened up because of the rebellion, and because of the default, has spread out even more. And see, it's actually impossible to move such a diverse thing forward, because as much as the leading edge wants to envision light and life and move forward, it's being held back by the trailing tail. I mean, you know, at times the revelators admit they don't even know what the solution is to this. How do you get this so that it really can be moved forward? Because the degree to which you engage the leading edge, like you're talking about, there's some really intelligent people and whatnot, you engage the leading edge and kind of enlighten them, it diffuses back in. You can't separate them. I mean, they literally set up a rigorous caste system in India to try to somehow keep the tail from, you know, corrupting the head, and it didn't work. You know, and almost no one on the planet, you know, can think about being that aggressive anymore. You know, we can hardly stand leaders anymore because, you know, they're too, like, mean and definitive. So we've got a difficult problem here. How does this planet actually go forward? You know, and all, underlying all of this is a genetic issue, like the revelators say over and over again. I mean, there are those that aren't so genetically limited that can kind of pull themselves aside, engage the fifth epical revelation, let go of all their primitive ideas and move forward. But the main evolutionary stream, no. I mean, you just can't. You put a little drop of chocolate in that vast sea of milk and it washes out, and you never know you put a drop of chocolate in there. It gets so diluted. So, you know, the revelators are all, I mean, remember how much the primary Supernafim, you know, that's the chief of Seraphim, talks about, boy, I'm kind of hoping it's any hour, right, that there's someone that comes, you know, or someone that steps forward, because, I mean, even he doesn't really know how you move this world forward. I mean, who's going to sort out this genetic issue? I mean, you know, can you do it in some kind of evolutionary way where you tighten things up by genetic engineering and kind of, you know, rip everything and then move it forward? Or does something really, you know, inconceivable for us these days have to happen where you just slice off all of the really problematic genetics?
And we're not the only planet.
Yeah, right.
So, and then probably it's been had before in other universes, you know, and in other places. So there's, yeah. And as you said many times, it's going to work out. It's just the question is, how is it going to work out?
Yeah, you know, I mean, is there some way that it kind of can gently evolve, or does there have to be some sort of a really redirecting cataclysm thing, you know? I mean, you know, it may not have to be something interventionary. Coincidentally, quote unquote, there may be some sort of natural thing that springs up and that just wipes out a lot of humanity.
Maybe scientific breakthroughs helping correct things.
I mean, we don't know how this
wiping
is.
Wiping out still change it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, could such a thing be selective enough? I mean, we know a number of things like that tend to actually. You know, like think about the, you know, the intertribal warfare amongst red men. Like they say, that tended to eliminate the best genetics. That was not helpful. So, yeah, I mean, you know, but we, you know, we can't even talk about genetics, you know, without being accused of, you know, atrocities of thought. I mean,
wait, Chris,
it's very difficult.
What percentage of mankind have genetic deficiencies?
Yeah, good question.
Percentage.
I mean, I'm not an expert at all, or I could even make a guesstimate, but I do know that with each passing decade, there are more and more genetic diseases, genetic-based diseases that are beginning to haunt us. You know, it's like our genetics is becoming more and more Swiss cheese.
You mean mental disease?
Well, I mean, initially it's just physically, but you know, your mind is attuned to your biology, you know, and if the more the body has holes in it, you know, Swiss cheese, like the more your mind has, you know, defects and deficits, and again, they're very clear in the book that we have these issues, but it's also clear from many of the relevators that not even they know how this is all going to be sorted out. There's those that are very much hoping that Machaventa comes soon and takes the reins on the whole genetic problem and leads mankind forward in the science and technology that we would need to fix some of the genetic problems that we've got. And you know, right now, you know, we're just, you know, treating the symptoms, right? Have we eliminated diabetes? No. You know, we just give people insulin or whatever. Right? I mean, but, you know, I always use that as an example because, you know, if the normal Darwinian sort of a thing was going on, I wouldn't be here.
We've eliminated the effects of Roundup on plants.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm just saying, so that's a beginning in terms of genome is starting, people are starting to look at it and really realize, and you can see the path where that begins to work on disease and people start looking, and they're already looking at, you know, there's blasphemy, but they're looking at it from a human level already. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right, eventually that will, it's got to grow, and you know, and we have to get out, as what you mentioned earlier, of the fear aspect of things.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when death doesn't become such, you know, the end of everything,
mm-hmm.
then I think it's a little bit different situation, because right now it's like, oh gosh, that person's going to die. It's the end of the world. It's the end of them.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, because we've become basically quite godless, actually.
Yeah.
In a way,
and hence, all the more fearful, right?
All the more fearful, right? But you've got a nation like India with billions of people who, as you mentioned earlier, you know, you get the vibe when you're there that it's quite a religious nation. In other words, it's definitely a lot of their life is more centered.
The cult structure is present. The cult structure is present, like
yeah,
they said.
Right. I mean, so there's, you know, there's things to work with.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I just, you know, I mean, if I get to you, I'm going to finish, you know, see, you know, to what I was saying to you earlier, you know, bringing up diabetes, you know, my dad, you know, if it had been a little bit, you know, back in the past, would have died because of his diabetes. But instead, he passed it on. And see, you know, to me, you know, I mean, I'm not diabetic, but, you know, I mean, the genetic issue is being was passed on to me and my two brothers. And, you know, see, that's why the genetic nature is getting worse and worse and worse, because more and more we keep people from dying and allow them to procreate and pass on their genetic issues. So it's just, you know, multiplying.
There are many new doctors, including California especially, mm-hmm. Dell Victory and others, that believe vaccination is causing...
Yeah, right. Sure, there's all those things. All the fears about environmental things causing genetic problems.
Well, I think just the nature of, I mean, the more we become universalists, the more we're all drinking chocolate milk. Whether we buy it at the grocery store and it's just white milk.
Mm-hmm.
Or soy milk.
No, chocolate milk comes from brown cows. Don't you know
right,
that? White milk comes from...
We're sacrificing our heritage to open our minds and culture. So our cultures are becoming a McDonald's swamp mix.
We have cultural issues. We have social issues. We have biologic issues. And see all those different elements of issues. That's why what we have right now is not a religious emergency or a scientific emergency or whatever. It's a philosophic emergency. I mean, it's this very holistic thing. I mean, everything, you can only talk about all of it, in a holistic way by saying it's a philosophic emergency. We have no way. We need a systemic reformation. We don't need a part reformation, and we have no way to do that unless we're given help. I mean, that's why the book is here, to at least give us the potential of using it to get a bigger philosophic frame and think about these things differently. But do we have the courage, like we were just talking, do we have the courage to face genetics? Are we just, did the Nazis make us so fearful that we're just never going to talk about that again, like it was, the Tetragrammaton, and you can't say it out loud.
Hope we can say Yahweh.
I guess finally we're allowed to say Yahweh out loud. I mean, maybe there's hope. This is what we're up against. Not to mention things have slipped so far for so many people. Most people on the planet could care less about a book like this that is challenging them so systemically to rethink every avenue of human endeavor.
Let's read 2,000 pages.
Yeah, even reading 2,000 pages, we got more and more people graduating from high school in the United States that can't even read. Or you show them a picture of a cow and ask them what kind of an animal, and they go, a giraffe? Are they anywhere near Romantic philosophy even? Let alone the fifth epical revelation. So we could just go on and on. I mean, how is this going to be dealt with? We're going to have to trust that it's obvious we're not going to bootstrap ourselves out of this problem. We need to trust that things will happen or people will come from on high to help us, right, that supplies a path forward.
But just this last paragraph, it said, in India, the time is right for
something.
So that means, it means you got to at least give it a shot.
Does ripe, of course, their definition of ripe is probably not my lifespan, but...
it's going to happen in your lifespan,
but
it takes a long time to get anything.
But, compared to 1,000 years ago, they're saying it's ripe compared to what it was 1,000 years ago.
But if you don't do anything, then it's not going to ripen.
Right.
In other words,
you have
to start somewhere. Yeah. Well, I would imagine, as you say, evolution eventually gets there, but it doesn't get there in a vacuum. In other words, it gets there because gradually people do things, and people read this, they get enlightened, and they try and enlighten other people, and one thing leads to another. It takes time.
But
this is a good hint, anyway, on how you might want to approach that part of the world, I would think, at least for a start.
Okay. Yeah. And
encouraging to me, anyway.
And just to kind of wrap things up here tonight, this whole issue of, well, what is going to happen that, sort of supplies a practical path forward? We're going to be reading next time about what happened in the 6th century BC, totally unexpected by even the Melchizedeks, that were here, and everyone else. Distilling out of the wholeness comes some enlightenment in the spiritual quickening of the 6th century BC. I mean, the more I've thought about it over the years, the more I'm inclined to think that the answer is not going to be in, so much in Machiavelli Melchizedek or Jesus' second coming or a magisterial son or something like that. Kind of the old school thought. More and more, I'm becoming biased to the opinion that probably what's going to be what's going to get us forward is something that that no one is anticipating, including the authors of this book. That there's going to probably be a coincidentally, as it were, that will distill out of the hole, that will give us a booster shot. You know, maybe, you know, one of the things that could do is get it so that there's enough leader material people that recognize this for what it is, that this actually doesn't just disappear into the dustbin of history, you know, and it's actually what we leverage off of to get a bigger picture that takes us forward. I mean, you know, I don't know if we're going to engage this just in and of ourselves. There's a handful in this room, but okay, most people are oblivious and will be until the day they die and have no interest. And, you know, we may need another spiritual quickening to really vivify this, the truth, in people's minds. I think it may just inescapably fall too flat right now. You know, like they're saying, trying to go to a place that doesn't really have a culture anymore, has no cult framework, you know, like Europe mostly, and trying to move that forward. You can't make something out of nothing. So, all right.
Archangels feeling the pain of, well, how's this supposed to work?
I mean, you can be suspicious. I mean, you know, like they say, do you know what it means to have a divisional headquarters of the archangels on your world? It's like, and we all go, no. well, see, I mean, I suspect. See, it's a foreshadowing. It's like a little catalytic seed, telling you that don't be surprised if this coincidentally becomes a coalescing point. Right? You know, and oh, coincidentally, they kind of knew that in advance without knowing it, and just happened to be here, and you know, yeah. You probably have those sort of foreshadowings of there's some things that are going to happen, and it's not because Michael's going to wave his magic wand, okay? It's not going to be like that. It's not going to be so fatherlike.
He might be behind it.
He might, yeah. I mean, yeah. He's certainly going to be, you know, yeah, you know, involved in it in the supreme level. But just, you know, that, I think that's more, you know, what's probably going on. You know, is that there will be this spiritual quickening. There will be a coalescence. There will be a reawakening of philosophy, you know, that will allow civilization to go forward. Okay, enough said. So we definitely fleshed out the rest of India. So we'll start... we'll start fresh again on China next time and see how it went when the Melchizedek missionaries ended up there. Did they have better soil there or what? Well, we'll see that all next time. Let's take a moment, everyone.